This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Decades of late-night reruns have left America with an indelible image of battlefield medicine inseparable from green tents and rebellious doctors.
Is that really his gallbladder I'm holding?
Ain't his money belt, partner. Hold it.
Ready to close now, doctor.
I'll be right there. In the meantime, look for your wristwatch. Surgeon's joke.
But those more familiar with modern combat cite a more realistic scene of medical treatment in the movie Black Hawk Down.
I got no more IVs. Now listen, Jamie, I gotta do something. It's gonna hurt. Okay? I gotta cause you more pain, but I have to do it to help you. All right? You understand?
Morphine.
I can't. It'll lower your heart rate too far. I'm sorry. Here, Twombly, why don't you take his hands there? I need you to hold the wound open and keep pressure on the top of the leg. Yurik, you're going to take the feet and a flashlight on my count. All right, Jamie. All right. One, two, three.
In this hour of Talk of the Nation, we'll look at different aspects of medical support for troops currently in and around Iraq, from the rapidly evolving science of trauma care to the age-old problems of military hygiene. Military medical personnel handle health problems most doctors never see. At the same time, the military is broadening how it measures the health of its troops, treating the psychological as well as the physical toll of combat and addressing the needs of a co-ed force. New technology and new complications coming up, but first, joining us on what I'm afraid could be a difficult satellite telephone line from an airbase in Southwest Asia is Naval Flight Surgeon and Morning Edition commentator, Lieutenant John Slaughter. And John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Neil.
In a commentary from before you deployed, I understand the movie and media references we made may not be appropriate to your situation, not necessarily Black Hawk Down or MASH. You write about Groundhog Day.
Yes, our situation over here at the air base at which I'm located is not, as I've seen other situations depicted in the media and in movies and television. We actually are at Desert Air Base, where we take care of a lot of the air crew that is performing the air campaign that's going on in Iraq.
I wanted to ask you, there was a clip we played earlier, and I'm not sure how long we can stand this this phone line, for which we apologize. But you mentioned a lack of sunscreen for the troops. Has that situation been resolved at all?
That was the case before while we were preparing to leave on the deployment, but we actually took care of that before we left country. And I've gotten an overwhelming response in terms of making sure that we were adequately prepared on that front, Neil.
Now, one of the things that you're responsible for is people who need to be awake for very long periods of time while they fly missions and maintain airplanes and that sort of thing. What is involved with that?
Well, with our current operational tempo, our air crew are flying an incredible amount of hours. So the role of flight surgeons in the Navy and the Air Force here is to follow the air crew and to ensure that they're tolerating those increased hours and they're not having too many problems with fatigue, Neil.
One of the things we learned about in Afghanistan, and this followed an unfortunate incident of friendly fire, but that some pilots are given what are referred to as go pills. What are those and do you dispense those?
I'm sorry, couldn't hear that last question, Neil.
This involved go pills.
Go pills are actually a measure that we save as our last resort. The majority of my roles in terms of managing fatigue are ensuring that people are getting an adequate amount of crew rest, ensuring that they're eating well, exercising, and being prepared to go on this. So we reserve that as really as a last resort. Yeah.
Go pills are basically a mild amphetamines. I wonder, you also wrote in one of your Morning Edition commentaries that...
As I mentioned, we save those if that's needed at the end, but often the other anti-fatigue measures that we employ ahead of time are well enough to ensure that the people are capable of performing the full extent of their mission, Neil.
Okay, and one other final question, John, and that is we played a clip from MASH earlier, and I understand that that was part of the reason you decided to go into the field that you're in now.
Out there.
I'm sorry?
actually cut out there, Neil, and I could not hear the entire question.
Well, John, I'm afraid we're going to have to decide that this line is not usable beyond this. We thank you for your time, though. I hope you can hear that.
No problem.
Okay, appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on the program. Yeah.
Thank you. Lieutenant John Slaughter, a naval flight surgeon currently deployed to the Gulf, and you can hear his commentaries from time to time on NPR's Morning Edition. We're going to be taking your questions on battlefield health this hour. Have you heard about a problem or a procedure that has you curious, wondering how military medicine has evolved since MASH went off the air? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences in Bethesda, Maryland, is Dr. David Burris, interim head of surgery there. And Dr. Burris, thank you for joining us today.
Hello, Neil. Thank you for having me.
And as we just heard rather intermittently there, I'm afraid, from Lieutenant Slaughter, military medicine for flight surgeons, medics, it can be very different depending on where you are.
Very much. Everywhere from Walter Reed, which is a world-class fixed facility hospital, down to a few people with a backpack at the front edge of a battlefield.
Now, you've trained a lot of the medical personnel now who are now in the Gulf. For the most extreme conditions, for battlefield conditions, how do you train people for that?
Oh, goodness. First of all, we insist that people learn standard world-class medicine, and whatever the specialty they're trained in, surgery, internal medicine, they learn that well. Then the key is to teach them the mindset that allows them to figure out what the goals of their medical care are and not fixate on the tools that they use in the normal situation, so that they can adapt the world-class care they know how to give to the situation and the tools they have on hand.
So, in other words, they may not have that particular piece of equipment that they become accustomed to.
Right.
Now, battlefield medicine is not something doctors can get experience in, really. I understand that some of the doctors are sent to train at trauma facilities in big city hospitals.
Exactly. A lot of our surgeons in the military routinely take care of all the different kinds of maladies that plague the human condition, and don't necessarily practice with to take care of the high-end trauma or practice with the team that they would normally deliver that care in the battlefield. So these trauma training centers, and there's one each for the Army, Navy, and Air Force right now, allow the team to train together, caring for a trauma patient under very real tense situations where they can learn to work together as a team, work out the priorities together, and get very good as a team before they're deployed into those kind of situations.
There's a saying that is familiar to anybody who's studied military campaigns. You always train for the last war. But in this case, I wonder if that's, in your case, such a bad thing. What has the military learned from Desert Storm?
Part of what came out of, at the tail end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War, the concept were large fixed battlefields or large footprint battles that had huge hospitals that were able to support the wounded, and then actually much of the care would be done in theater. With a very mobile battlefield that calls to mind the North African campaign from World War II, the battlefield moves very quickly. The maneuver units are moving very quickly, and so the large footprint hospital cannot keep up. So smaller and smaller units were designed to take care of those people who are in the most urgent need of care, to stabilize them, do a quick surgery to stop bleeding, and then their care may, their next step of their care may be separated not just in time but in geography.
We read, for example, the American prisoner of war, the PFC Lynch, who was just found last night, is already on her way to Germany.
That's right. And in fact, that's the way a lot of the care works. If you can do a stabilization operation for somebody that's been badly injured, stop the bleeding now, and then do the next step in Germany or a larger hospital farther from the front, it's not too dissimilar. In our big trauma centers, we may do a stabilization operation in the emergency room, go to the ICU, do some resuscitation, and then go back to the OR at a later time. Mm-hmm. So the time lag is not unknown. It's the fact that the time lag is also coupled with a geography change.
If you have questions about medical care in this war, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org, and our first caller is Kenneth, who's with us from Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Actually, it's Vicksburg, Michigan.
Oh,
I'm taking my call, Neil.
Okay, I apologize for that.
No, I heard your lead, and it brought back memories of my experiences in Desert Storm. I was a trauma treatment team leader, one of the mobile units your last guest discussed. And shortly after the 100-hour war, I was put in service as part of the team taking care of refugees in Safwan on the northern border of Kuwait with Iraq. We got several media visitors looking at our operation because that was one of the focuses, of course, after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told we were going to be a 60 Minutes focus. The producer came on smoking a rather phallic cigar and said, well, I hear you're having trouble getting the right supplies. I said, no, actually, they've been very responsive. We've got baby formula and things like that. Yeah, and I hear there's a lot of resentment from taking care of these Iraqis right after you had to war with them. I said, actually, no, two of them have been translators for me. And he said, okay, thank you very much, and canceled the segment. I'm distressed at the seeming lean to focus on the negative when, in fact, there is a great deal of heroic, great things being done here. And, you know, we haven't heard much of a story on how quickly we've taken care of not only the POWs and the civilians, but the soldiers themselves without having to evacuate most of them.
Hmm.
I think that, you know, I've got a great many friends on active duty right now, and I'm very proud of the work they're doing.
Dr.
Safwan, we actually took care of about 300 to 400 refugees a day with just a team of 14.
Well, Dr. Burris, let me ask you about the responsibility. Of course, the Geneva Convention, I believe, requires U.S. medical personnel to treat Iraqi military wounded as if they were our own. Is that
absolutely
right?
Absolutely. And they take that very seriously.
Yeah, let me hear from Dr. Burris.
Absolutely, and I agree, and I thank you, Kenneth. It's this type of citizen soldier that makes this this country great. Not just a Geneva Convention, those kind of agreements grow out of the Hippocratic Oath we take, and that we care for those who are injured, wounded, ill, based on the need and prioritize based on the need at the moment.
But if you're in a combat situation, do you risk running out of supplies for your primary purpose is to be there for U.S. military casualties? Do you, if you're taking care of lots and lots of civilians?
Well, it's always easy to construct a scenario where what if you get to the worst case scenario, the mindset is to usually you don't have that glut of civilians when you're in that intense a situation where you have to worry about your people overrunning your own supplies. Clearly, in any time that you get into a mass casualty situation where your supplies are limited and your endurance is limited, you have to make tough decisions on who to treat next. But in general, it still defaults to the person that needs the care most the next.
Well, Kenneth, thanks very much for your phone call. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, and God bless.
We're talking about health and medicine on the battlefields of Iraq, and we'll take more of your questions after a break. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Boy, I've always wanted to read over this music, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking this hour about battlefield medicine. Our guest is Dr. David Burris, interim head of surgery at the Uniformed Services University in Bethesda, Maryland. And, of course, you're invited to join the discussion. If you have questions about how medical aid is organized in a combat zone, or if you've had firsthand experience with hotspot healthcare, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, or you can send us email. The address is TOTN@NPR.org, and we've gotten a lot of good email questions. Dr. Burris, why don't we begin with this one from Steve Sewer in Spokane, Washington. He writes, with the weaponry of this modern age, such as the AK-47 and the damage it can do, how does a doctor deal with the immense amount of trauma to the body done by such weapons? It would seem that such trauma would be fatal more often than not.
Well, in fact, the death rate on the battlefield before medical care is reached, the KIA rate, or killed in action rate, has been pretty much the same since war began, and especially since high-velocity rounds, such as he's describing, were invented in the 1880s. We like to use the mantra that we treat the wound and not the weapon. Certainly, these kind of weapons can create more damage than first is evident, and the surgeon has to be aware of that, and be astute to look for the damage and to treat the damage. But again, if somebody survives to surgical care on the battlefield, the death rate is only between 2% and 8% in most of the last recent wars in the end of the 20th century.
In research, reading up for this hour, I read that the most serious problem is, in fact, bleeding.
Correct. In fact, those that die on the battlefield, most of them die about half within the first 5 minutes to about 30 minutes. Of those, about half are massive injuries that no one can fix, or neurologic injuries. But the other half are from hemorrhage that conceptually, if it could be stopped, the person could be saved.
And I've also read of some high-tech bandages that are just beginning to be introduced.
Yes, in fact, that's the concept. When you imagine that most of those deaths occur in such a short period of time, no matter how close you put the surgical teams, the bottom line is either a buddy or a medic is going to have to be the one to control that bleeding. And we haven't had any real change in bandage technology since about the Civil War until recently. In fact, the clip you played from Black Hawk Down, that particular soldier inspired a whole chain of research on the part of the surgeons saying, if I could have put something into the hands of that medic to stop that bleeding and that wound he couldn't control in the normal way, perhaps that soldier could have lived. And in fact, that's what's inspired the present bandage research. There's three different agents that are fielded currently, two bandages and one powder that operate on different mechanisms to try to offer something to that medic to control the bleeding long enough to get the patient alive to medical care.
One way or another, they try to induce clotting to stop the bleeding.
That's right, sir.
Okay. Let's go to another phone call, and Linda is with us from Hickory, North Carolina.
Hi, Neil, and good to hear you on the air again. I wanted to ask, I'm looking at Time Magazine's brand new edition, April 7th, and there is a Marine. It looks like he is tending to another Marine who was injured in the Nazaria fight. Now, I'm wondering, is there a medic with each division, or are the soldiers just trained to take care of immediate first aid until a medic arrives? I guess that's my question. Is there a medic in each division?
Yeah, the three different services deploy their there's four: Army, Navy, Air Force, and the Marine Corps deploy their medics differently, and each of the services has a certain amount of training that they give to their individual soldiers to give what's called self-aid or buddy aid, so that they can be trained to try to stop bleeding at the point of injury until the medic can get there if they are in a unit that has less numbers of medics. The Army in general has maneuver groups that have medics with each one. The Marine Corps is, in general, dispersed a little more, and so they rely more heavily on the buddy aid and self-aid than perhaps some of the other services. But yes, they are given training on how to do that, since that's the number one cause that is potentially treatable, how to control the bleeding in a buddy.
Linda, thank you.
Thank you.
Here's an email question from Barb Sutton. This may seem like a morbid question, she asks, but how do forces on both sides recover war dead and injured from the battlefield? Is there a time when a truce is called for soldiers to be recovered? It's just something I've always worried about. I wondered about, she says.
Yeah, well, classically in our image of fixed battles, World War One and things like that, there would be times when people might call a truce for the people to go and clear the wounded from the battlefield. In a situation where the line is moving quickly in one direction, then the graves registration people that job that is to collect the dead can catch up to the line to behind the line of battle and collect the casualties. So yes, there's people who are designated to do that. Sometimes it does come down to cooperating to get those, but in general, from our standpoint, as we come to those individuals in the movement of the battle, soon behind come the individuals that are to care for those bodies.
But going out to help the injured, if they're under fire, that's clearly a dangerous moment.
That certainly is, and in fact, there are probably more medics that receive medals for valor than just about any other kind, and many of them who receive them posthumously. And one of the things that we have to train carefully our medics to do is to recognize that while they want to, the best thing they can do for their injured comrade is to get them out from under fire, to become injured themselves prevents them from doing the best. But it's a tough call to go get that person out from under fire, and it comes from the heart. Those people are real heroes.
Hmm. Let me ask you a question that was occasioned by the terrible sandstorms that we saw in Iraq last week, and that had to do with simple amount of sand that was blowing on people's faces and hands. You know, after a while, doesn't that sort of abrasion, I mean, you talk about chapped hands, doesn't seem like a serious problem, but does that develop into a problem?
Oh, sure can. The groups have to be very careful to keep lotion, things, face cream, sunblock, etc., to keep the skin up to speed, to protect against things. But certainly, after a while, abrasions could be a focus for a portal for infection, or it just you've had them. Chapped hands can be painful, and it can impact. But you have to continue to do the right things that you would normally do. It's just accelerated in time a little bit.
Joining us now is Lieutenant Colonel Elspeth Ritchie. She's Program Director for Mental Health Policy and Women's Issues at the Department of Defense, and it's good of you to join us today.
It's good to be here. Good afternoon, everybody.
Psychological health during deployment is a fairly new concern for the military. How has it evolved?
Actually, it's not a new concern for the military. We have learned throughout the wars in this century that the psychological health and well-being of our troops is critical, both for the troops and for the war effort. Overall, throughout World War I, World War II, the Korean War, etc., we have learned that if you take the health of the troops seriously, we do much better. And so what we've done is we've put into place a number of interventions to work with soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines before they go into battle, and also after battle, to retain their sense of physical and psychological health.
So you have a baseline that you can compare them to?
We have, certainly we have the baseline before they are deployed,
mm-hmm.
and then we also have the baseline looking at other conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you a little bit about what we do. First of all, we try to prepare our troops for battle, and much of that preparation is not done by mental health folks, but it is done in basic training and other trainings to prepare the troops physically and mentally. And then if a troop is having some difficulty, and in intense combat it is easy to think that almost anybody would have difficulty with the sights and sounds and smells, we'll work with them as close to the incident as possible. And when we say work with them, a lot of this is fairly basic supportive therapy. We have some principles that we've developed, again, over the last 100 years, which we use an acronym called PIES, Proximity, Immediacy, Expectancy, Simplicity. And that basically means you treat them up close to the battle with the quickly, that's immediate part, with the expectation of return to duty, and simply.
Mm-hmm.
Much of our care is what we describe as three hots and a cot, good night's sleep, and some food. Unfortunately, in today's environment, the three hots, well, that's maybe three MREs.
Right, and they're only hot if they've been out in the sun.
Exactly. But with the expectation that most folks are going to do pretty well, and just about everybody really wants to return to be with their unit, to be with their buddies.
Okay, let's take a question from a caller. Worth joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Thank you very much. Another excellent show and timely topic. It's fortuitous. I got some of my answer in listening to your most recent guest. But I'm a two-tour veteran of Vietnam, served with a combat unit both tours, and have done some work. I'm a clinical social worker now by profession, and am interested in, I know that you prepare soldiers for war, and I understand that concept, but particularly when you have a friendly fire incident of Marine on Marine, or you have an unfortunate killing of a civilian, as in the van the other day,
mm-hmm.
I wondered if there was an employment of a critical incident stress debriefing and follow-up counseling for potential post-traumatic stress related to what some people would call a wrongful death, but I call the unfortunate of war. And I'd like to hear any advances in that quick, immediate response to debriefing or preparing that individual to live with a killing that didn't occur within the conduct of war.
Yeah, it'd be terrible guilt, I would think. Colonel Ritchie?
Yes, that's a wonderful question. The whole concept of critical incident stress debriefings actually arose with the military, and we used it in the operational context. We called it operational debriefing. The question has been raised recently. Debriefings have been used somewhat indiscriminately at times and not necessarily in the military. And the question has come up, is a critical incident stress debriefing appropriate in all situations? We, along with the National Institute of Mental Health and the VA and others, recently convened a conference to look at best practice guidelines in this issue, and we've published the results of our conference. In brief, though, a debriefing may well be done in traumatic events. At other times, the decision will be made, this isn't the right time to do a debriefing, let's work with folks one-on-one. So a debriefing is part of the tools in our toolkit, but may or may not be used depending on the situation.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the question, Worth.
Okay.
Colonel Ritchie, aside from the stresses of combat, there must be a lot of factors that trouble soldiers that may be less obvious to us.
Yes. Traditionally, some of the real things that trouble soldiers are their concerns about the home front. If they're worried about a child who's sick or about a spouse, that may cause them to not function as well. And one of the recommendations we make to commanders is to try to stabilize the home front as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then certainly the sights and sounds of combat, as your previous caller suggested, soldiers may be very concerned with their actions and the effect on the civilian population. So they'll be taking all that into account. One of the jobs of what we call the combat stress control teams is to help the soldiers focus on the mission and to do their job as effectively as possible.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Colonel Ritchie, you also oversee women's issues for the Health Affairs Department. Women make up now 15% of the armed forces, somewhat less in the Marine Corps. How does that change health care for forces that are in the field?
Well, we try to promote force health protection for all sexes, or both sexes, not all sexes, And we emphasize, though, particularly a few things for women. We want to make sure that they have enough hygiene equipment available for them so that they don't develop any gynecological infections. We find, though, that emphasizing personal hygiene is a boon to both sexes and not just to women.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Burris, hygiene historically has certainly been a major issue for doctors in every campaign.
Oh, absolutely, and the soldiers in the field have a tendency to not have the time to wash as they should, and certainly hand-to-mouth infection causes a lot of downtime for military people. The campaigns in the last century, or actually the century before that, were fraught by hundreds and thousands of people out from diarrheal diseases. And those are the kind of things that the commander must be aware of to make sure that the troops do use good hygiene, to ensure that they are appropriately changing their clothes, their boots, their socks, and so on as necessary to avoid the kinds of conditions that might put them out of action.
Colonel, I wonder, I think our listeners can probably come up with most of the obvious health issues for female soldiers in their own imaginations. Are there less obvious accommodations that have to be made?
I think the readers would understand, or the listeners would understand, that bathrooms are very important, whether it's the toilet facilities or the hand washing. I'd like to segue onto what Dr. Burris said, though, is one of our real successes has been those infections that have felled our troops in other conflicts. We have very few of now. It is rare that we have a diarrheal outbreak that actually incapacitates a troop. So we've really made a great many strides. And this is something that is in many things in the military, is something that the leaders really have to do, take the lead on, and they've done that.
Well, briefly, I think the forecast temperature tomorrow on the border of Kuwait is 100 degrees. Heat, dehydration, obviously those are major factors.
Yes, and so we are encouraging the troops to drink as much as water as possible.
Okay, well, Lieutenant Colonel Elspeth, we appreciate your being with us today.
Thank you, and I'll remain available if there's any questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Lieutenant Colonel Elspeth is Program Director for Mental Health Policy and Women's Issues at the Department of Defense, and we appreciate her time. Here are some of the latest stories from NPR News. The U.S. Army and the U.S. Marines are closing in on Baghdad. Both are reported within 30 miles of the capital city. We'll have reports on that from NPR's Mike Schuster in Kuwait and Jennifer Ludden at the Pentagon. Also, Kurdish fighters and U.S. airstrikes have forced Iraqi forces to retreat from villages in northern Iraq. NPR's Ivan Watson is in northern Iraq. He'll have a report. You can hear those details later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. Here on Talk of the Nation, we're talking about medical support for the troops in Iraq. We'll have more of your questions on the phone, 800-989-8255, and on email, totn@npr.org, when we come back from a break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, while the war in Iraq gets most of the camera time, the war on terrorism continues around the world. We'll check in with global trouble spots from Pakistan to the Philippines tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today, we're talking about military medicine for the troops deployed in Iraq. Our guest is Dr. David Burris, who's interim head of surgery at the Uniformed Services University in Bethesda, Maryland. And let's go right back to the phones. And let's go first to Andrew, who's with us from St. Louis.
Hello. Two quick comments. Actually, a comment and a suggestion, if you will.
Okay.
My dad is a veteran of both Desert Shield and Somalia. And in Somalia, they had the same problems with dry skin, et cetera, due to the heat, and plus some rather nasty biting insects. They weren't given anything specifically for it, but the best thing that they found from experience was Avon Skin So Soft, which they were literally not for everything, but they were actually able to trade it in the field for various other items. It literally became a hot commodity.
Dr. Burris, certainly skin bites can be a major problem. Sand fleas can give you leishmaniasis.
Absolutely, and having personal experience with the Skin So Soft, it is effective and it does work. There was a problem for a period of time, and I don't know if Andrew knows the answer to this. It wasn't available. So if he knows of a source, then that would be useful.
I'm not sure Avon services Mogadishu.
Yes, it is a little bit of a trouble there to get the ding-dong and deliver. But, yes, it's amazing what the troops do discover. And, in fact, just a little MacGyver's Guide to Surviving in the Field sometimes are the kinds of things that troops pass on from one to another almost by word of mouth. And from the more experienced passing on down the things that you should take with you to protect against a variety of things, there's quite a whole separate culture of people that codify and collect those kinds of things. And Skin So Soft is one of those high on the list.
Just to, sorry for interrupting, but to answer your guest's question, as far as supplies go, I know that between the Marines and the Navy Combat Camera, they sold out or bought every bottle in San Diego County before they left.
Andrew, thanks.
Another thing I'd like for your guest to mention that I'm familiar with and but other people might not be are the Navy's two hospital ships. I know one of them is out there, and I was on board as a guided tour, and I know just by looking at it, those things are about as equipped as a mini Bethesda.
Absolutely, and in fact, many people from Bethesda help staff the Comfort, which is one of the options in this campaign, and it is very much the kind of next level of care that on the continuum of care we mentioned earlier, going from the very small footprint, very austere surgical team, moving back. That back can cross service lines, geographic lines, can cross from an Army field hospital to a Navy ship, can cross from an Air Force forward surgical team to an Army hospital in Germany, for say. And, yes, that's definitely one of the options for a next level of care.
Mm. Andrew, thanks very much.
Okay.
I wanted to get to this email question from John Woods in Indianapolis. Americans who watched MASH, and we played a clip earlier, have come to believe that battlefield triage is similar to that in a civilian hospital or emergency department. However, he writes, my understanding is that battlefield triage is essentially the opposite. My question, is it true that battlefield triage is essentially patch up the lightly wounded first so they can return to the fight quickly and then treat the more seriously wounded thereafter?
Ah, good question. The in general, no. In general, they still do the care as you would normally. Those that are most injured first, and that you have the highest likelihood of helping first. The there are situations where you begin to be short of supplies, where you may have to make tough decisions that somebody is so badly injured that even if you invested all your supplies and all your people in that one, that they may not survive, and then the ones that could have benefited would not survive as well. So that's a tough call. That situation usually doesn't exist in our civilian hospitals. The situation they described there, the reverse triage, well, talked about, fortunately, rarely would come into play. If a unit were about to be overrun and the battle were that bad coming towards you instead of moving away from you, then it would contribute to the survival of the most number of people to consider that kind of an option, to get people back into the line to prevent that to being overrun. And then that way save the most people. Fortunately, that's rarely a consideration that needs to be dealt with.
Jason Bennett from Plantation, Florida writes, I've heard that most modern handheld weapons, such as the M16, are designed to wound, not kill, because a wounded person takes two out of the fight. A dead person can be left behind.
Hmm. Interesting concept. People have accuse people of designing the weapons that way. But certainly it depends on where it would hit. The same round hitting an arm or a leg would wound. The same round hitting directly in the middle of the torso would kill. And so it's not entirely accurate.
Okay. Let's go now to Laura, who's with us from Savannah, Georgia.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air, Laura.
Oh, hi, Neil. It's good to talk to you. I love your show.
Oh, thank you so much.
And I appreciate the MASH clip. It brings back fond memories of watching that show. My husband's with the 101st Airborne out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and he is in the 86th Combat Support Hospital. And I just wanted to talk about how proud I am of him.
Thank you.
Yes, he has been with the 86th for about 10 years now as his profis, which is not his regular job, but if we go to war or have peacekeeping missions, he's with them. And their hospital is the first combat field hospital that's impervious to biological and chemical threats, which I'm very happy about. And they have trained a lot before he left. They trained for 3 weeks, came home for about 5 days, and then left at the end of January.
Well, we're proud of him, too. And, in fact, the 86 was one of the units that some of our people helped do some of the training for. So I'm sure that some of our we have mutual acquaintances, I'm sure. But best wishes to you and your family during this time.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Laura. We appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
We got an email from somebody else. My nephew writes, Timothy Van Fossen, my nephew is a nurse in a combat support hospital, we presume, in Iraq. How far behind the lines are combat support hospitals located, and how are they protected, especially given the irregular forces and asymmetric methods employed by the Iraqis?
Yeah, the combat support hospitals are a little larger than the surgical units we described. Comparing to the MASH unit, of course, it's hard to tell how big MASH was from the show because you had many characters wander on and off.
Mm-hmm.
But the forward surgical hospitals have, depending on which branch of the service, the Army would have 20 people that could handle about 2 OR beds at a time. And a smaller number of patients than the MASH unit. The MASH unit was about twice that size, and the combat support hospital, again, about twice that size. So being that large, it's farther from the front, has more capability, more ability to handle patients after they've been operated on and keep them for a period of time. And as far as protection, that comes at two levels. The unit themselves, the soldiers in the unit carry sidearms for protection of the unit, and then the surrounding units, the combat units that they support, have a very much vested interest in ensuring that the hospital is protected because at some point they may need that care.
Well, Dr. Burris, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
David Burris is interim chair of the Department of Surgery at the Uniformed Services University in Bethesda, Maryland. He was on the line with us there, and we'd also like to thank Lieutenant Colonel Elspeth Ritchie, Program Director for Mental Health Policy and Women's Issues for the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, and she spoke with us earlier from her office in Falls Church, Virginia, and I wanted to thank her for her time. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.